Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here, and we're trying something new, packaging three of our favorite segments from the week for you to listen to on the weekend in case you missed them. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Have a great weekend. We begin today with a look at the Thomas Piketty phenomenon, which can only be called that, a phenomenon. The new bestseller by the French economist, if you haven't heard about it yet, is 577 pages long. And as it happens, it has spawned approximately 577 reviews, blog posts, think pieces, and more. Everyone in the world seems to have written and talked about Piketty's book called Capital in the 21st Century. The left sees it as final proof of the corrosive effects of concentrated wealth. The right sees it as more class warfare. So now, seven Thomas Piketty think pieces we read so that you didn't have to, and the seven questions they raise. This is how it works. When you wait long enough in the news cycle, you can just have others set up your questions for you. It's easy. And to help guide us through our tour of Thomas Piketty think pieces is Mike Consul, fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, who writes about economics at Rorty Baum. He did his duty and wrote a Piketty think piece too, which is generally favorable, but also serves as a great roundup of various reactions to the book. So no better person to guide us. Mike Consul, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
And for people who don't know, as I'm trying to, you know, approximate the French pronunciation here, the name is P-I-K-E-T-T-Y. So it looks like Piketty to an English speaker, sort of Piketty if you're doing it in French. And think piece number one. And we start with Gillian Tett in the Financial Times. She writes, quote, Piketty's tome is exhaustively researched and contains numerous statistics showing that the American economist Simon Kuznets was wrong to argue back in the 1950s that economies would become more equal as they matured, unquote. Now, that may sound a little dense, folks, but talk to us about that language, Mike, that background, because it's really important. The idea that economies would become more equal as they matured, which Piketty sort of argues has been the driving idea of modern capitalism. That's fundamental, right?
Right. So if you look back at the 1950s, which was the last time economists really surveyed this data, they were looking at the time right around then. And the thought was, and this is basically taken hold in the economics profession, is that, you know, during the Industrial Revolution, you had a lot of inequality. Before the modern era, you had a lot of inequality. But something about mature economies as they, you know, kind of, you know, as you have a broader middle class, as you had more educated people, as you had a lot, you know, broader tax base and all this, the economy would naturally gravitate towards equality, towards more equalness. And so, you know, a lot of economists would say, you know, even though there's been a lot of inequality lately, and, you know, a lot of people are worried about that, given enough time, given a generation or two, it will naturally bring back to, you know, a more equal base, or, you know, not pure equality, of course, but a much more, you know, egalitarian distribution of resources. And what Piketty says is basically that mid-century period after World War II up until about the 1980s is really the anomaly we have to explain. A lot of our indicators are going back to the late 19th century.
So the real shift in focus with Piketty isn't on the way the wealthy get rich, but the way that that wealth is then concentrated and protected.
Absolutely, right. And so basically the tendency of old wealth to grow faster than new wealth. So, you know, he has a phrase that the past devours the present. And, you know, basically what he's saying is that as the wealthier get wealthier, they take up more space, they take up more of the focus of the economy. And that's, you know, he talks a lot about literature through it. He talks a lot about cultural things. It's a very long book. It's like 600 pages. And, you know, he basically gives a broader holistic view that, you know, under this kind of inequality, you know, the past will really tend to dominate the future, and it will look a lot more like the late 19th century, which should be our default thinking as opposed to the 1950s.
And listeners, we should say that we have posted all the quotes and the charts that we will be discussing from the various think pieces that we're reviewing on our website. So for extra credit, or you could think of it as the Thomas Piketty debate spark notes, go to our website and follow along at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You will see the raw material we're working from right on the page. And no piece of that raw material is more fascinating than this chart that we're about to discuss. From Piketty Think Piece number 2, and not surprisingly, the left has latched on to this argument. In Esquire magazine, there's a piece called The Most Important Book of the 21st Century. And, of course, the only way to follow up on a headline like that is with a graph. So do you want to describe this graph that we're looking at, which actually begins at antiquity and runs to the present, and why people think this is so revolutionary in analysis?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's important to understand that the book itself, before you get to the debates about inequality, which will become very heated and political,
right,
just as a data source, it's a fantastic book. It's all an exhaustive global project to unearth historical data about how the economy has evolved. That's, you know, amazing, and I think a lot, that itself is worthwhile. Now, the graph, which is available on your webpage, has two things. You're often going to hear people talk about R greater than G. I think that's the kind of, you know, who is John Galt kind of equivalent of this book.
And when people tweet, like, you know, it's like wearing the mask that people associate, the Guy Fawkes mask that people associate with the Occupy movement, right? If people are tweeting,
right,
R is greater with the greater sign for math, R is greater than G, that means I'm a Piketty fan, right?
Right. That's the code, I think, that, you know, hopefully there won't be, you know, spray paints of it or anything like that, but maybe there'll be buttons or something. But crucially, so what the graph shows is that R, which is the rate of return on capital in the economy, it's basically how profitable it is if you own something. And it's, you know, a very narrow measure, and it encompasses everything from stock ownership to home ownership to land ownership if you're, you know, you own farms in the 17th century. If you combine that all into one rate of return, you know, if you invest $100, how much do you have a year from now? He says basically it's been about 4 to 5% from antiquity up until the World War One, essentially. And he goes through a bunch of historical things, but he also historical data, but he also goes through novels, for instance. And, you know, you can pull apart Jane Austen novels and read about how, you know, where it's very clear that's a 5% return. Now, what he's saying is that the shocks of World War One, World War Two, the Great Depression, and the kind of wave of legislation that came out of there, you can think of things like the war mobilization in the U.S., the New Deals, you know, the New Deal and, you know, the subsequent waves of reform like Social Security and labor reform, that is what all those things combined, and we'll talk about later about which ones were most important, drove down the rate of return. And we also had a huge growth spurt where, you know, there's a period where we were, you know, a really productive economy. We innovated very quickly. You know, people went from, you know, had indoor plumbing and, you know, very quickly. So the growth was bigger as well. And now we're back, we're moving quickly back to the old period where the rate of return was much higher and growth was much lower. And that tends to exacerbate the inequality. That's when the wealth of the past, which is, you know, essentially the return on capital, is growing much faster than the economy in the present, and that tends to have the past dominate the future.
And so, for example, what we've been seeing in this country recently, just to put it in very simple, concrete terms, with the stock market rising so much faster than the general rate of growth of the economy or the general rate of growth of average people's wages, that's R is greater than G, right?
Absolutely. That's a framework to do it. And, you know, it's funny, I see it getting mentioned when it comes to, like, the stock market like that, but also when it comes to things like, you know, someone pointed out, like, rich kids of Instagram or whenever you kind of see these, like, displays of wealth that are very, you know, gratuitous, you can kind of think, oh, yeah, of course, R is greater than J. So I'm curious if that'll evolve and be caught as a kind of catchphrase.
Mike Consol from the Roosevelt Institute, giving us our 7 think pieces we read so you didn't have to, guide to the Thomas Piketty book on capital, which is all the rage around the world right now. I think we can say that literally. And let's move on from what Piketty thinks is wrong to the what he thinks should happen part of the program. And we turn to Felix Salmon, formerly of Reuters, and his think piece on the book. And basically, Salmon isn't buying it. I quote, Piketty's rather French idea of a global wealth tax isn't getting nearly the same amount of acclaim as the rest of the book is, and is very unlikely to happen. Countries will always compete with each other to attract the stateless rich by not taxing them, unquote from Felix Salmon. So want to explain this Piketty idea, his proposal for a global wealth tax?
Right. So the book ends on a couple of notes, but the thing that is most caught on is the policy solution is a global wealth tax that's coordinated internationally, at least among the rich countries. So you can think of Europe and North America. You know, he proposes this for a couple of reasons. One is that he thinks it's necessary. He, we'll talk about other possible solutions in a minute in another thing piece, but he thinks it's necessary. It's necessary to kind of divert some of that wealth towards the public purpose, towards funding important public goods and social insurance and whatnot. He also wants it as a means of accountability so that, you know, if there is a tax, even if it's a very small tax, I believe he proposes a 2% wealth tax in it, but he says we can even start lower, but he wants it so that the wealth is visible. Right now, a lot of wealth is in tax havens. It's essentially disappeared. He quotes a little bit about how if you add up all the wealth claims, it seems like we owe Mars a bunch of money because there's a bunch of claims on wealth that just don't exist on Earth, which means that they're essentially hidden in tax havens. So he thinks if you have to pay just a little bit, it'll expose it to democratic scrutiny. We'll have a little bit better sense of what's going on. And from my point of view with the text, it seems like a very European solution that did, you know, the book is originally written in France, in French, and it seems like much more focused on the mix of EU and how they're going to fund themselves.
And it seems to me, though, that whether you think the tax would work or not, the big step here is that Piketty is putting a fine point on the idea of wealth inequality as opposed to income inequality. Yes?
Absolutely, yeah. The book, you know, there's a reason it's called Capital. And, you know, often when we think in terms of U.S. inequality, we think in terms of labor inequality, which, you know, is basically, you know, there's a janitor and there's a CEO, and the CEO makes 500 times the janitor, where before he only made 300 times or 100 times. You know, if you get to choose how much money you're making in a year, if you're cashing out stocks, if you own a business, that's really the kind of capital, that's income from capital. And that tends to evade taxation in a way that your individual labor income doesn't. It's taxed at a lower rate. We can remember Mitt Romney paying, I think, like 12% taxes, or Warren Buffett paying less in taxes than his secretary. That's the kind of wealth inequality we're talking about. And his idea is to put the wealth tax back on the agenda in a way that, you know, people can then react to.
And so on to think piece number four. And hey, it's yours. You wrote in your own piece about Piketty in the Boston Review that, quote, he is in a way saying, go ahead and make whatever reforms you want, break up the banks, pass the campaign finance package of your dreams, reach deep into the bag and pass all the non-reformist reforms you could think of. All your reforms cannot guarantee that you are safe from the logic of R is greater than G. So why did you write that?
Sure. So an initial wave of the debate, so there's been a ton of reviews of the book, and a general complaint from more liberal-minded reviewers, especially liberal-minded reviewers who are economists who work with policy and work in D.C., is that he doesn't have a really good story about how we can use more regular regulations to fix this. Like, would a higher minimum wage help? Would more unions help? Would, you know, stricter financial reform help? Campaign finance help? And he has an ambiguous relationship with this in the book. I think what he thinks is that the big thing that came out of the New Deal and the wars were both the actual destruction, you know, of people, buildings, and claims, but also really high progressive taxation. If you are having a CEO pay 80% of any income he makes over $1 million, you know, that's going to cap a lot of inequality because the board will not make a payment that way. Crucially, what I read him as saying is, you know, so a lot of people are saying, you know, why don't we, you know, focus on financial reform or focus on patents or focus on health care? And he's
all the things all the things we actually usually debate in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the thing that's contentious all across the board, every day. He's saying, go, you know, he's a pretty lefty guy. So he's saying, yeah, absolutely, these are good ideas. You should do them. But I don't think they will change my dynamics. I think you really need to get serious about taxes in a way that people do not talk about taxes, which is like on wealth, you know, high rates, internationally coordinated and so on.
And our think piece number six comes from David Brooks in the New York Times, who not only sees a sort of class warfare angle, which conservatives don't like about Piketty, but more centrally, he thinks that Piketty is missing the point when it comes to the role of government and how to actually help all these people in the 99% or however big it is who are disadvantaged by the concentration of wealth. Brooks writes, what conservatives need to do in response is, quote, emphasize that the historically proven way to reduce inequality is lifting people from the bottom with human capital reform, not pushing down the top. In short, counter angry progressivism with unifying uplift, unquote, writes David Brooks. So do you think he has a point that Piketty is having a conversation about taxing the rich? Ooh, those bad guys up there, they've concentrated so much of the wealth for themselves, when we really should be finding ways to help the middle, which taxing the rich doesn't actually do?
Sure. So, I mean, when you talk about inequality, you're usually having three conversations. One is, the relatively deteriorating position of people who are poor right now, people at the bottom of the income distribution. A second conversation about people at the median who, depending on how you measure it, are having stagnating or slightly increasing incomes, but, are suffering under health care costs and education costs and so on. And then there's the issue of the 1%, people at the very top of the income distribution who are having really runaway incomes. It's very easy to fight over what should be the priority when we talk about inequality, and those are three very important issues. And you can always judge which one is the most important. I don't think up until this point we've had such a definitive account of what is going on at the top 1%, and particularly one that kind of points to the fact that it will not fix itself on its own. That problem will, I mean, if you view it as a problem of a very small group of people claiming a huger part of our economy's resources, just won't naturally take care of itself. So, I think this puts it on equal – I don't want to say equal footing, but it puts it on the agenda in a way that where it's very obvious why we should be worried about poverty or stagnating wages, it wasn't clear – a lot of people were very optimistic about the 1% issue taking care of itself. They can no longer say that after this book.
And this is a fundamental step he takes. People even on the left have been willing to concede the idea that the rich should be allowed to get super rich as long as we help the very poor and the middle be comfortable. But Piketty is kind of saying that the very rich are actively impeding the rest of us just by concentrating their wealth.
There's a political story there, but there's also just a straightforward economic one. He makes a case that's plausible. People are debating it, that in addition to the wealth just concentrating, it will also take up a bigger share of the economy. So, all the wealth we make in our economy is paid out either to capital or labor, and lately labor's been getting a smaller share of it. And that directly impedes, middle-class people, working poor people, everyone. And he's saying that will actually get bigger. It will go from, 25% to 35 or 40%. And that, I think, will be the real bite. And that is what has a lot of people worried. And that actually makes the 1% problem interconnected with all the other problems.
Mike Consul, our guest from the Roosevelt Institute, as we talk about the book that is all the rage and topic of conversation among economists and policy wonks in the world the last few weeks, by Thomas Piketty, the French economist called Capital in the 21st Century. And as we near the end of our tour of seven reviews of the Piketty book that we read so you don't have to, number seven, Tyler Cowen in the New York Times, who writes about how many French economists are baffled by the reception that their fellow French economist is getting here in the U.S. He's been on the scene there for a while and in some ways is seen as, passé by this point in France. So is this just a matter of the U.S. catching up to a conversation that took place in Europe a decade ago?
It's a good question. I mean, I think people in France have politics that that deal with aristocracy, deal with high taxation, deal with taxes more generally in the way the U.S. does not. The U.S. has a real entrepreneurship feel. It has, we built this, it has a, small business focus. There's never been an aristocracy here outside, historically, certainly not in the same way there is in Europe. So it's a very new concept to Americans. So I think that's of interest to them. I think there's also an issue where Americans like it when French people show up and kind of explain the country to them, which is always very fascinating. And the book, though it's obviously very political, doesn't feel partisan. I think in part because it has a historical international focus and it's written by someone outside the U.S. So I think it's going to be convincing and interesting for people who don't particularly like partisan media to really kind of deal with these very deep, important economic issues.
Now, listeners, I refer to you to our comments page because some of you are starting to post links to your favorite reviews of Capital in the 21st Century. So keep them coming. If we collect every one of the reviews, this could be the longest comments page in the history of WNYC or the history of comments pages. But keep that Piketty conversation going at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. We have to end it here for the radio portion. But we will say apologies to Heidi Moore, Paul Krugman, Ross Douthat, The New York Sun, The New York Post, National Review, Jonathan Chait, and many others. Yes, we read your think pieces too, we promise. And we thank Mike Consul, fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, who also writes about economics at Rorty Bomb. He's been our tour guide to the Thomas Piketty think pieces, and you can find a link to his piece, as well as all the others we cited today and some of the charts and graphs, on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehr on WNYC, and we turn now from controversy in professional sports to a statewide development in high school athletics. The Board of Regents voted yesterday to make high school cheerleading an interscholastic sport in New York State, which means new safety regulations for competitions. Yes, folks, cheerleading is a sport as of yesterday in New York State. Not in New Jersey or Connecticut, by the way. But if you have ever seen a cheerleader somersault through the air and land on top of a pyramid of other cheerleaders, you know why this needs protection. What you may not know is that cheerleading has one of the highest rates of serious injury in sports. We've talked about the issue of brain injury and concussions for young men in sports. Now we're going to talk about young women and why they might be particularly at risk for head injuries. And listeners, the phones are open for your calls on the issue. If you're a current or former high school female athlete, call in and tell us about safety in your sport, whether it's cheerleading or lacrosse or soccer or anything else. 212-433-WNYC. Or if you ever played high school sports as a girl in the past, 212-433-9692, or parents or coaches of girls' teams, 212-433-9692, specifically on the relationship between this decision yesterday to officially declare cheerleading a sport and head injuries, 212-433-9692. As we welcome Dr. James Noble, Assistant Professor of Neurology at Columbia University Medical Center, who specializes in concussions and sports-related head injuries of all type. Dr. Noble, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me on, Brian. Pleasure to be here.
Is it important, in your opinion, that the Board of Regents has declared cheerleading a sport?
Absolutely. I think this is a long time coming, and it probably follows along the lines of the greater consciousness that we've all developed for a number of both high school, collegiate, and even professional sports that have a high risk of having head injury in the course of contact sports. Cheerleading, as you intimated when you're introducing the segment, is not commonly put in the same sentence as those other sports that are more recognized as having the competitive and contact sport nature to it. But clearly, it's a sport with very high risk and warrants a lot of safety and observation.
I'm looking at a graph of the percentage of concussions among injuries in different high school sports. And boys ice hockey is number one, with around 23% of the injuries in boys high school hockey being concussions. Girls lacrosse is number two at around 21-22%. And then cheerleading is number three with over 20%. And again, that's of the injuries that cheerleaders get, over 20% of them are concussions, one of the highest percentages in any sport. So what should we conclude from this graph?
I think it makes some sense if you're considering the sport as maybe we should. I think a lot of us think about cheerleading in the context of the cheer team that's on the sidelines next to a football game, but this is actually competitive cheerleading. These are the competitions that maybe a lot of us have passed by on the ESPN channel or something like it, where you see these large squads throwing cheerleaders way up in the air or having them assemble into pyramids and then collapsing safely back down to the ground. You know, these are potentially high-impact injuries with people being thrown up in the air, sometimes 12, maybe even as high as 15, 20 feet in some instances, depending on the athleticism of the team. And so if you can imagine, if that player is not caught or caught incorrectly, they're either going to hit the ground with the force functionally of falling out of a first or second story window, either against themselves or the person who's attempting to catch them.
So it's like gymnastics, except it's gymnastics done in front of a crowd that happens to be cheering for the boys' basketball team or something. And yet when I look at that same graph, the percentage of concussions of total injuries among female gymnasts is actually very low. Less than 5% of gymnastics injuries are concussions, while more than 20% of cheerleading injuries are concussions. How do you explain that?
Well, it has to do with the velocity of the injury when it occurs, and also the just the if you think about what are the mechanisms of injury that somebody may get in the course of gymnastics. If you imagine Mary Lou Retton doing a floor routine, she's going to do a couple of tumbles up in the air, but she really is not going to be able to get any higher than she can jump. And even some of the highest dismounts that a player may have would be from the uneven parallel bars, and those will be perhaps about as high as a gymnast might go, just because the bars are way up in the air. But in cheerleading, in contrast, these players are being routinely thrown up as a symbol of their athleticism, way up in the air. Like I said, they're hitting themselves as they strike the ground, or they're hitting another player, perhaps head-to-head contact as they come back tumbling down to the ground.
Carolyn in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Ah, thank you. I just wanted to call in and say that I agree that that cheerleading, A, is a sport, and B, should have better regulations. When I was in middle school, we were practicing doing stunts without mats on the wood floor, and I fell on my face, and I've had to have surgeries up until last year. So from the time I was 13 till 28, I've been dealing with fixing the problem from that injury.
Wow.
So I agree that, you know, it is very dangerous, and I don't think people really took it seriously.
And you think this will help?
Absolutely. I mean, I think mats are obviously essential, and also spots. You know, we were young girls that were holding each other up and not necessarily strong enough, so I think even improving, like, workout time, strengthening, I think it should be taken more seriously.
Carolyn, so. Thank you very much. 212-433-WNYC. And Dr. Noble, there's been research that I've read showing that young female athletes show more symptoms of concussion when they get concussions, and that they take longer to recover. If that's true, what would account for that?
It's really not clear. I mean, there have been a lot of issues that have been discussed, whether they be symptom reporting, that perhaps women athletes have different thresholds for reporting symptoms, or perhaps there's a physiologic difference in that we know that the brains of men and women develop differently. They're prone to different factors. Estrogen has been proposed as a potential factor for both injury and recovery. But generally speaking, it's not well known. Some people have proposed in the realm of football that players with weaker necks or less robust musculature in the necks, maybe those which are more prone to developing concussion after head injury, are more prone to getting one in the first place. And so neck strengthening exercises have been proposed, but not much of a scientific basis has supported that approach. Nonetheless, it's being espoused in a number of circles, and perhaps there's something about the way that a head moves on the body of a woman athlete versus a male athlete.
And some studies have suggested, relative to how the head moves, that this is related to the growth spurt the teen girls go through, usually a little earlier than teen boys, you know, leaving their heads relatively bigger than their bodies, but their bodies kind of gangly, you know, at a certain point of development.
That's true, but it seems as though that even past those periods of development, that women athletes are still at great risk for developing concussion, such as the case in women's lacrosse, no matter whether it's a high school or a collegiate athlete.
Uh-huh.
You would argue that women's collegiate athletes are still developing.
And that self-reporting aspect that you mentioned is interesting, if true. As you say, I don't think that's been proven, but just like guys are less likely to ask for directions when they're lost, maybe they're
right.
Less likely to tell their parents or their coaches that they think they're hurt after they get a concussion.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting point. I will say, of the women athletes that I've met who have had injuries, they are fiercely competitive, no different than the men. I've taken care of Olympic athletes and collegiate athletes, and they are just as eager to get back into the game as their male counterparts. So the argument of having, you know, a greater tendency of reporting concussion symptoms, I'm not so sure, at least on an anecdotal level, it
mm-hmm.
holds much water. But there may be something different about the way that these injuries are experienced and expressed.
Jessica in Rockland, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jessica. Jessica, you there? Jessica in Rockland County.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Oh, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to call and say, because I cheered for 16 years and I coached cheerleading for the past 9 years, I definitely think that it's a necessity that it's considered a sport. There's just so much involved that people don't realize, and it is very dangerous. I know myself, because I've had quite a few injuries from it. and it's definitely needs to be taken more seriously.
What do you think is going to change, Jessica, for any of the programs that you've been involved with now that the state of New York has officially declared cheerleading a sport?
Well, now that they declared it a sport, I feel like there's more that they can do. You know, as far as the competitions and stuff, there's only so much they can do because of all the regulations that they have that people don't take seriously. But now that it'll be clarified as a more serious situation, there's more they can do as far as competitions and stunts and, you know, tumbling and all that stuff, where they're able to actually do it without feeling like they can't because they're restricted. With more guidelines and regulations, it helps more as far as what they want to do when it comes to competing.
Jessica, thank you so much. And so to wrap up, Dr. Noble, I think we all agree that high school cheerleading, now declared a sport in New York State, is a big deal. It will be subject to the same safety protocols on the sidelines as high school football or any other sport. So from your medical perspective, what kind of training do high school coaches now need to get for identifying and dealing with concussions and brain injuries? What's the protocol at the sideline for any high school sport that now would officially pertain to cheerleading after yesterday's vote?
Well, the standards began to sweep across the land, the nation really in beginning in the early 2010 era, and following a series of Leistet laws, which are named after a football player in the state of Washington named Zachary Leistet, who had had catastrophic injury following two concussions in the same game. There was a letter sent from Roger Goodell on behalf of the NFL to all states in the union, the governor's offices, and one by one, most of the states, if not all the states by now, have these Leistet laws in the books, which mandate that anybody really from coach to trainer to anybody having contact with an athlete on the sidelines has to be certified through a standardized training program that they're aware and able to assess a player for potential concussion on the sideline. They don't have to diagnose it, but they have to be aware that the player may have sustained a concussion. And that's been available now for this training through the CDC. So there's a free online program called the CDC Heads Up Program. I've taken it myself. I actually work in my own town's athletic association, and we've made it mandatory for all of our youth coaches, even down to kindergarten level, to be Heads Up certified, just as a symbol to say that we take this seriously and it's important for the safety of our players. But it also enables us to put teeth to the fact that everybody who has a suspected concussion has to be formally assessed by a licensed physician in the state of New York before they're allowed to return to play.
Dr. James Noble, professor of neurology at Columbia University Medical Center. He specializes in concussions and other sports-related head injuries. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it's the last day of April, which means we're getting this in just under the wire because April is National Poetry Month. But I am joined now by Vijay Seshadri, who this month was awarded this year's Pulitzer Prize for Poetry for his collection, Three Sections, which the judges called, quote, a compelling collection of poems that examine human consciousness from birth to dementia in a voice that is by turns witty and grave, compassionate and remorseless, unquote, from the Pulitzer judges. He came to this country at age 5 with his parents from Bangalore, worked as a copy editor for The New Yorker, now a professor at Sarah Lawrence College, and like the 2012 winner, Tracy K. Smith, lives in Brooklyn. Welcome to WNYC, Vijay Seshadri.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on your Pulitzer Prize. And you're being claimed now by each of those parts of your bio. Newspapers in India are pointing out that you're the first South Asian to win the prize for poetry. The New Yorker wrote a tribute. Sarah Lawrence seems excited. And the papers here describe you as a Brooklyn poet. Do you claim all those identities?
Absolutely, yeah. I would claim all the identities I can get. You know, it's like our greatest Brooklyn poet, Walt Whitman, of course, said that he contained multitudes, and, you know, if I contain 3 or 4 people, I'm sort of on my way there. That's nice.
And Brooklyn contains multitudes, which is maybe why it produces so many great poets.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we live in a really rich poetic environment there, and, you know, especially my neighborhood in South Brooklyn is crawling with poets. I mean, and...
So you've agreed to give the listeners some samples of your poetry, and we asked you to read part of, or I guess all of, because this is a short one, This Morning. in three sections, which kind of fits one picture of a Brooklyn poet. You ready?
Yeah. So I'll read this morning first. This morning. First, I had three apocalyptic visions, each more terrible than the last. The graves open and the sea rises to kill us all. Then the doorbell rang and I went downstairs and signed for two packages, one just an envelope, but the other long and bulky, difficult to manage, both for my neighbor Gus. "You're never not at home," the FedEx guy said appreciatively. "It's true. I don't shave or even wash. I keep the air conditioners roaring. Though it's summer, one of the beautiful red and conifer green Bayside fuel oil trucks that bed down in the depot by the canal was refreshing the subsurface tanks with black drafts wrung from the rock, blood of the rock sucked up from the crevices. The driver looked unconcerned. Leaning slightly on each other, Frank and Louise stepped over his hose and walked by slowly, on the way to their cardiologist.
Ha. Huh. So is that the poet's lot? Grand visions, apocalyptic imaginings, interrupted by FedEx guys and fuel oil deliveries?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. And that's sort of... It's the kind of interaction that one has when one sits down to writing in a sort of, in any environment, but particularly in a dense environment like a city like Brooklyn and a city like New York, that there are all of these noises and influences and odd inspirations And one of the things that I think urban poets, especially New York poets in the past 30 or 40 years, have been very good at is sort of capturing the pulse of the city, capturing its quality. And it's been a real aesthetic adventure for New York writers. And to the extent that I'm a New York writer, I tend to think that I should do that too. And that poem is an example of sort of, my living in my neighborhood, my environment, my Brooklyn environment, and sort of rendering it on the page as life was happening around me. Mm-hmm. And, some of those incidents are, the FedEx guy never told me that, and of course.
That you're never not that, home.
Right. But Frank and Louise did step over the hose and walk by slowly. I don't know if they were going to their cardiologist, but they're neighbors of mine who were old and had health problems. So I just...
And you could find the poetry in that simple act of them walking by your building.
Yeah.
The title of the collection is Three Sections, and it's roughly divided between, I guess, standard-length poems like the one you just read, a long prose piece on Pacific Fishes of Canada, which I haven't read. I don't know if you're channeling your inner John McPhee there or what. And a 16-page poem called Personal Essay. And you'll read for us in a minute from that. But what do the three forms offer you as a poet? Shorter poems, one really, really long poem, and a prose essay.
Yeah. I think the long poem, which I'm going to read from, sort of... is just a part of a continuing ambition I have to write a long poem. And so it was motivated as much by my literary understanding and my literary ambition. Pacific Fishes of Canada, the prose memoir, is basically about a couple of months I spent on the Bering Sea working as a biologist for the National Marine Fisheries Service in my youth.
Uh-huh.
And that was just there, I think, because I have a lot of interesting biographical material that I've never known how to put together in a book. So I parked it there in preparation for putting it in a book at some point. And then the lyric poems, the short ones like the one I just read, are ones that, I typically write. So I kind of divide the book in my mind this way, that the larger material is sort of about America in a way and my experience in America, And the shorter material, the lyric poems, are things that I would write wherever I was, just as a poet. I mean, they're more determined by poetry than anything else. So
do you want to read from the 16-page poem, Personal Essay, and do you need to set up the section you're going to read at all?
Yeah, this is a little section that actually emerges in Brooklyn. What's happened in the poem up until now is that there's sort of been a real internal meditation on the part of the speaker of the poem, who seems to be sort of lost in the labyrinths of his own mind, and then he emerges out of his own mind, and this is a little description of his emerging in the poem into the world he's actually living in, and I will read it. I'll start.
Great.
Slowly the mind finds itself in a cab. Slowly the mind finds itself in a cab on Atlantic Avenue. Suddenly it occurs to the mind that the fact that they make people live here on Atlantic Avenue reveals, as nothing else can, the criminality of this social order. Along the wound that is Atlantic Avenue from Flatbush to the sea, hacked out by a blunt axe disfiguring the earth, they pack them in by the tens of thousands. They surround them with discount tire outlets and disreputable used car dealers. Broken, unfathomable streets spreading out into Bed-Stuy and Crown Heights. Gloom under the elevated tracks of the Long Island Railroad, with which tracks a malevolent municipal authority has chosen to stitch this thoroughfare for miles and miles. Dismay in the undergirders spattered by mourning doves, lamenting in the crevices. Who here doesn't understand what they mean when they talk about the tears of things?
Wow, that's not a pretty picture you paint of Atlantic Avenue.
Yeah. When I go to JFK, the cab usually takes, the Atlantic Avenue route, and I'm sure many of your listeners have been on that route, and it is pretty forlorn and desolate in places there.
Do you think if you lived in the countryside, you'd write about meadows and daffodils?
I probably would. Yeah. I mean, I don't think, I think that is sort of a kind of vision of a certain kind of urban desolation, which is a part of our experience if we live in urban areas, but it's also in the poem just a moment. And it's kind of, the poem sort of rises and falls in many ways, and that's probably the lowest it goes, but then it tends to kind of climb to other heights. And that is sort of, and I do think, especially I think, when I look at various neighborhoods in Brooklyn that I don't know, I say, well, what do the people do there? How do they live? How do they pay their bills? What is their life like? Because it's such an enormous borough, and there's so many people and there's so many neighborhoods. And when one has lived in a place a long time, and I've been in Brooklyn now almost 30 years, you kind of the mind goes to thinking about the people around you.
It's a good thing, better than not thinking about the people around you. We have 30 seconds left. What does it mean to you to have won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry?
Well, it's an enormous kind of honor, and I'm just sort of, I'm enjoying it, but I'm also, baffled and bewildered by it. Because, most of us poets, we tend to sort of, the limelight doesn't shine on us, and that's fine. I don't consider myself as living in obscurity. I've had a good career so far.
And now the light shines more, but we will have to leave it there. So thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And congratulations, Vijay Seshadri. His collection, 3 Sections, won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, and he's a professor of writing at Sarah Lawrence College. We have links to more of his work on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.